Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at CedarPoint.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and today we're going to be talking about a piece of legendary architecture. This will be sort of in the tradition of our episodes on, we did one on the great Buddha in Sichuan,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, and like that episode, you know, we're gonna be focusing in on this particular work of architecture, this particular thing that people have made out of the earth. But in doing so, we're going to get a chance to discuss a little history, a little theology, and perhaps, overall introduce many of our listeners to maybe a part of the world you haven't heard about or a part of our shared history that you may not be that familiar with. Because when you think of great constructions, you know, what comes to mind? You think of the Great Pyramids, the Great Wall of China. Perhaps you think of Stonehenge or the ziggurats of Mesopotamia, the Mesoamerican pyramids perhaps. And these are all fabulous. And these are just a few examples that we can turn to for amazing marvels of stonework, architecture, and construction throughout humanity's history. And with all of them, we revel in the study of their construction, right? How did, in many cases, ancient people refine the raw earth itself into the necessary building blocks? How did they transport all this stuff then to the building sites? And then how did they assemble these structures that end up standing, you know, the test of millennia while the empires around them rise and fall, and yet these structures remain?
You know, something we've discussed a number of times is the way these ancient structures they demonstrate mysteries about past engineering techniques that very often tend to cause people to want to go to outlandish alternate hypotheses. You know, all
yes.
the ideas about how the pyramids were built. You always get the aliens hypothesis, and like, you know, why is it that people want to go there with that kind of thing rather than just thinking, wow, ancient people must have been so clever to come up with ways of making such amazing structures with the limited tools they had.
Right. Yes. Like the idea that ancient Egyptian humans built the pyramids is, to my mind, plenty amazing. You don't have to go to the even more amazing and outlandish idea that aliens came from another world and showed them how to do it. I mean, really, it's far more interesting to examine the truth and seek the truth of the situation. Like, how did actual humans carry this out? How did they, even with their, you know, their limited technologies, figure out how to achieve these marvels?
But it's not just the pyramids. I mean, I think it's fascinating that sooner or later an aliens hypothesis shows up for all of these, you know, for Stonehenge, for mm-hmm. the Mesoamerican pyramids, for basically anything built in a pre-modern period that still looks amazing today.
Right. And I mean, really, if you wonder about anything that you maybe don't have a full grasp on how the pieces came together, like say bread, it's easy to think, oh, bread just does not seem to make sense. It must have been the gift of an alien culture. But we talked about this before. We did a whole pair of episodes on ancient alien hypothesis and what Carl Sagan had to say about it and other critics have had to say about it. But indeed, all of these locations that I've mentioned already, you can certainly find some ancient aliens folks out there that are chiming in on it. And I also ran across some related to today's episode.
Oh, no.
Because but we're not going to really get into that because the real story is the amazing part. We're going to be discussing a particular example of construction that is really just as amazing as, you know, making all these giant blocks, bringing them together and building the pyramid. But this particular example is also going to buck the traditional steps that we've discussed here. And we're going to be looking at centuries-old Christian temples in Ethiopia that were not built from blocks of stone that were, you know, quarried over here and then brought together and then assembled into a building. No, these are freestanding monolithic churches that are each hewn from the solid red volcanic scoria underlaid by dark gray basalt, standing tall in the quarries from which they were sculpted. So basically, these were hewn out of solid stone.
The quarry becomes the courtyard.
Yeah.
It's a building that is not built but released from the earth.
Yeah.
Subtractive manufacturing of marvels.
It is amazing. I was not familiar with these until just last week when I was looking around for an episode for us to do. And I was initially thought, oh, why don't we do Petra, the ruins in Jordan, you mm-hmm. know, with where the architecture is built into the side of this this kind of like ravine situation, right?
If you think you've never seen these rock-hewn buildings, you probably have. They're featured, for example, in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. They
yeah.
show up in several movies.
Yes, yeah. Petra specifically in this case.
Yeah, right.
So I was thinking, oh, Petra would be a good episode. And I started looking around about it. And indeed, Petra is fascinating. Perhaps we'll come back to it. But then I was just looking around at other examples of you know, buildings that had been hewn from stone. And then these just really stood out as just the prime example, like the most extreme example of what you could do with subtractive manufacturing of an entire building, to construct a building by not even constructing it, by just carving away at solid stone until it is there with no need for bricks or mortar or wood or nails or any of this.
Architecture as sculpture.
Yeah. So where will you find these? Well, you will find them in Lalibela, Ethiopia. Ethiopia is, of course, a nation in eastern Africa, and they stood there at least since the late 12th century CE, though, you know, we'll probably get into some of the dating in greater detail later. But first, just a few notes about Ethiopia in general. Modern Ethiopia is the most populous landlocked country in the world and the second most populous African nation.
After Nigeria.
Mm-hmm. Ethiopia is also considered one of only two African nations never to be subjected to long-term European colonization, the other being Liberia. And to be more specific, it was never colonized during that 19th century period where so much of Africa was,
mm-hmm.
Though it was occupied by Italy during the Second World War, but not long enough for there to be like true lasting cultural change because mm-hmm. of it. Still, throughout its history, it certainly came into contact with foreign ideas and influences, and we'll be discussing a major one here today. Because one of the other things you'll notice about Ethiopia is that its majority religion is the Ethiopian Orthodox Tewahedo Church, what's known as an Oriental Orthodox Christian Church, and it dates back many centuries. There's also a sizable Islamic population in Ethiopia, followed in popularity by Protestants, traditional faiths, Catholicism, and Judaism. Now, of course, there are other fascinating things about Ethiopia as well. For instance, Ethiopian cuisine has certainly traveled well around the world.
I think it's widely believed to be the origin place of coffee, isn't it?
Yes, coffee and okra as well. I chatted with Annie of our fellow podcast here in the Atlanta offices, Savor, and I said, hey, have you guys done anything on Ethiopian cuisine? Because we can mention it on the podcast. And they said that they had not yet, though they both love Ethiopian food, but they have done an episode on okra, and they've done an episode on coffee that get into those origins.
I'd say those are two of my favorite plant-based foods. Are you an okra fan, or are you one of those people who thinks it's slimy?
Oh, I love okra, and
okay,
I love it because it is slimy, especially in gumbo.
Oh, yeah.
Because it acts as a thickening agent. So I want there to be okra present in many a dish. Plus, it's great. It's great fried. It's great pickled. Yeah, I'm an okra fan for sure.
Okay, we're on the same page. I like it all those ways too. I also really like okra in Indian food.
Yeah.
I feel like, yeah, it goes really good with Indian spices.
Ooh, I feel like I've had it in Indian food before, but maybe not recently enough for it to really strike a chord. I'll have to seek it out.
There was a restaurant here in town that made a really amazing curried okra, and then they went out of business.
All right, well, let's talk in greater detail about Ethiopian Christianity then, because since we're focusing in on old Christian temples that were carved out of the ground in Ethiopia, we should describe how Christianity came to East Africa.
Sure. So I was looking at a scientific paper that we'll make a brief reference to later in the episode. And the authors of this paper, Ethiopian scientists Asfawosin Asrat and Yodit Ayalu, they point out in the background section of their paper that the broader tradition of rock-hewn churches in Ethiopia is historically associated with the coming of a group of figures known as the Nine Saints, who were alleged to have journeyed from Egypt and Syria during the late 5th and early 6th centuries to preach the gospel of Christianity in Ethiopia, and more specifically, to spread and promote the monastic lifestyle. So I was digging into this claim. I wanted to learn more about the Nine Saints, and this eventually led me down a path where I found a really awesome entry about Ethiopian Christianity and the Ethiopian monastic tradition in a book called The Encyclopedia of Monasticism, edited by the historian Will Johnston, with this specific entry on Ethiopian monastic Christianity written by the Ethiopian American philologist Getachew Haile.
I was reading this as well, and it is quite a fascinating entry. I just had no idea just how important the monastic tradition was for just Ethiopian culture in general.
Yeah, yeah. So Haile writes that due to the proximity of Ethiopia to the Middle East, some Christianity probably began to spread there organically as soon as the religion was founded. But Haile also claims that Ethiopian Christianity is a form of the religion that's kind of uniquely shaped by monks and monastic influences. So what exactly would that mean? Well, monasticism is the tradition we associate with monks and nuns. It's the strain of a faith that calls for a radical lifestyle of religious devotion, often including things like vows of poverty or vows of chastity or vows of silence or fasting, a general seclusion from secular life. So, you know, the priest or preacher within a religion might usually live among the society, preaching the faith. Meanwhile, the monk undertakes in some way to live outside the society, rejecting many of the comforts and pleasures of normal life, making their day-to-day habits and living conditions themselves kind of a radical demonstration of faith.
An interesting fact that the author points out is that it's currently really unknown how many monasteries are in Ethiopia because the government keeps track of churches, but not every monastery has a church, and not every mountain or wilderness center that is is historically a monastery is going to be active today. But he lists quite a number of them, and he also mentions Ethiopian monasteries outside of the country, such as in Egypt, where it looks like they now live alongside Coptic Christian monks there, but then also in Jerusalem as well.
Yeah, and we can come back to later on how these monasteries appear to play a very important role in Ethiopian religious life. So there's a legend about the founding of the Ethiopian Christian Church recorded by the 4th century Christian historian and scholar Tyrannius Rufinus, who lived in what is now northern Italy. And the tale told by Rufinus goes something like this. So in the city of Tyre, which is in modern-day Lebanon, you know, it's like Tyre and Sidon, there was once this philosopher named Meropius. And Meropius had two young students named Frumentius and Adesius. Now, one day Meropius decides he's going to set out on a sea voyage and travel to India, and he's going to bring his two students with him. But then tragedy strikes, and their ship sinks outside of a port that Rufinus writes is in India, but it's apparently widely interpreted to be a confused attempt to reference Ethiopia. So this is believed often to be Ethiopia that he's talking about. Mm-hmm. And the two boys are rescued and taken to the royal court of the capital city of Aksum. This would have been the capital of what's known as the Aksum dynasty or the kingdom of Aksum, where they were given employment by the king. And Frumentius became the king's secretary while Adesius became the king's butler. And through his position as secretary and his subsequent role instructing the young princes at the palace, Frumentius was allegedly able to eventually convert the entire royal court to Christianity. And from here, it's written that Frumentius encouraged the scattered Christians among the people of Aksum to organize into a church and to a school for the Christian upbringing of children. And then when Frumentius and Adesius were released from their positions in the court at Aksum, Frumentius allegedly went to Alexandria to convince the current archbishop there, Athanasius, to recognize the church in Ethiopia and look after its well-being. And in turn, Athanasius said, well, you'd be a good leader of that church. And so Athanasius and the other bishops decided to name Frumentius bishop of Aksum. So tradition says that in this way, Frumentius became the first bishop and the first apostle of Ethiopia. And he went throughout the kingdom preaching the peace of Christ, which is how he became known in the Ethiopian Christian tradition as Abba Salama, which means Father Peace. Now, Haile, however, casts doubt on the historical validity of this foundational narrative, noting that local sources don't really mention anything significant about Frumentius in this period, and that the historical evidence indicates the story was probably later introduced to Ethiopia after first being written by other authors in Greek. Haile writes, quote, "Undoubtedly, Frumentius was a bishop consecrated for Ethiopia by Saint Athanasius, but the local tradition has no memory of him and his efforts to Christianize Ethiopia." Doesn't history often work that way? You got a good founding story, but then like the locals didn't record anything about it. So it seems like it probably didn't quite happen that way.
Just in general, this sort of push and pull between reality and myth and that area in between where you're not sure where the history ends and the myth begins.
Yeah, it's always the way. However, Haile writes that much of the Christianizing influence on Ethiopia in the following centuries did come from missionaries, primarily monks from the Byzantine Christian world. And of course, you know, the Byzantine Empire at the time would have spanned much of the Mediterranean. So it would have people of Byzantine influences could be coming from like Egypt or wherever.
Right. And by the way, if you want a deeper dive into Byzantine culture and Byzantine history, we did an episode on Greek fire years back that we recommend.
Yes. So these monks of the Byzantine Christian influence would be arriving individually and in groups roughly between the 5th and the 7th centuries. And the most famous of these Byzantine missionary monks are known locally in Ethiopian tradition as the Nine Saints. Now, there's an interesting historical recontextualization that Haile gives here. He says that church historians generally believe that this group of missionaries
was actually on a kind of factional theological mission. They were trying to get Ethiopia to take sides in a theological dispute that was going on in the church, or to stay on their side. So at the time, one of the major theological disputes rocking the Christian church was about the essential nature of Christ. And the question is this: did Jesus Christ have just one nature where he was entirely divine or entirely human? Or did Christ have two separate natures, one of them earthly and one of them divine? Now, I know with that kind of argument, I'm sure some people are kind of rolling your eyes like that doesn't sound like a super meaningful distinction. But disputes like this were rampant in the early church, and they led to bitter, agonizing power struggles and sometimes excommunication, accusations of heresy, and all the concomitant punishments and, you know, et cetera. So these fights about the nature of Christ are known as Christological disputes. And these disputes are the origin of a lot of the dogmas that would later become, you know, widespread in the Catholic Church.
Yeah, I mean, because when you start asking the question, was Christ human or divine? If you then say, oh, well, he was human, or he had a human element, then you might say, well, how human? Was he human like you are, the rich clergy, or is he human like we are, the peasants?
Mm-hmm. That's a really great point, especially because while some of these distinctions might not sound super meaningful to us, they had implications, often like material political implications that aren't obvious if you just read about the pure theological dispute.
Right.
That's one thing I love about the Umberto Eco novel, The Name of the Rose, which we've talked about on the show before, is it deals with a lot of these angels dancing on the head of a pin kind of theological disputes, but also gives some shading about what their real world political and economic implications were.
Right, and how it ends up breaking down to the suffering of at least the common man anyway.
So anyway, the view that Christ had two separate natures, both divine and human, came to be known as Chalcedonianism after the Council of Chalcedon in 451, which ended with a sort of uneasy consensus upon the two-nature thing. And the view that Christ had only one nature came to be known as monophysitism. And this view, the one-nature view of monophysitism, was probably, at least according to this church historian interpretation, was probably represented by these figures known as the nine saints. They, you know, if this view is correct, they came to Ethiopia to make sure that the Ethiopian church continued to preach one nature in Christ and resist the two nature view.
And you can also see how they would be sort of be seeking to get ahead to this far-flung region of Christians and just ensure that they had the right version of the story, right?
Yes, yes. Though Haile says, while this is the thing that's generally suspected by church historians, nothing is certain. We don't know for sure about all the motivations of these nine saints. Locally in Ethiopia, the nine saints are not remembered for arguing any particular side of a Christological smackdown. They're mainly remembered for strengthening the faith of the Ethiopian church and for, again, emphasizing monasticism, the monk lifestyle. So these nine saints are said to have brought with them a number of important books, and these are widely believed to have included the books of the New Testament, but also books of Christian doctrine and education. So in evidence of the strong influence of monasticism in Ethiopia, Haile mentions that one of the first books translated into the Ethiopian language at the time, known as Gez, was a work known as the Monastic Rule of Pachomius, who was the founder of the Cenobitic monasticism tradition. Now, this is a type of monasticism that encouraged monks to live together in communities with other monks, like the abbeys we would traditionally think of, rather than simply living individually as isolated hermits, which I think is the older view of the monk lifestyle.
And of course, you still saw examples of that in Ethiopia as well.
Right. Yeah. You see both. So maybe we should take a break, and then when we come back, we can talk about the nine saints.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astepro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. AstaproAllergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. All right, we're back. So let's get to these nine saints. Who are they, and what were they? What did they allegedly bring to Ethiopia?
Okay, well, Haile mentions actually 10 well-remembered Byzantine monks who each founded a monastery in Ethiopia. The first one is not traditionally thought of as one of the nine saints, but he's historically very important, and so he bears mentioning. This is Libano Sormata, and legend has it that he heard the call to a monastic life on his wedding night.
Oh.
That is bad timing, dude.
Or perfect timing, I guess, you know?
I guess so. So on his wedding night, he's like, oh, no, wait, I've got to take a vow of celibacy. I got to go be a monk. So he runs off to do that. He apparently went to Ethiopia, where he founded a monastery and helped an Ethiopian monk translate one of the Gospels into Ge'ez. And then the next are who are traditionally thought of as the nine saints. I'm not going to mention biographical details or legends about all of them, just a couple of them. So the first one is named Aragawi or Zemikael, and he is known as the leader of the nine saints or the elder. Zemikael is also an appellation that means like devoted to Michael. The nine saints supposedly traveled from Egypt to Ethiopia with Zemikael as their leader. And legend says that, quote, the saint used a long serpent as a rope to ascend the impregnable summit of Mount Damo, where he built his monastery. All right. So they all build a monastery. This guy uses a snake to climb a mountain and he builds a monastery on top of the mountain. And this is a mountaintop monastery that still exists today. Obviously, historians do not think he actually used a snake to climb the mountain. But there is really a monastery there. It is attributed to him. It's in the region of Tigray, and it's famous for being only accessible by a rope-assisted ascent up a steep cliffside. So you really do have to climb a rope up a cliff to get to this monastery.
That sounds terrifying. And I also think that that might be the point. Of it, because there was another cliffside or mountaintop sanctuary that we ran across. I was looking at a video from Great Big Story about this, and I think there's also there've been BBC videos about it as well.
Mm-hmm. This other one is known as Abuna Yamata Ga, or the Church of Saint Abuna Yamata.
Yeah, and the video I watched showed how to climb it. First of all, you have to climb it barefoot.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final stretch is like, this is after you've actually ascended to a height on level with this small little monastery that's built into the cliff. You have to walk along this cliffside trail to the entrance, and it's just a sheer drop to your left.
Mm-hmm.
And the narrator was talking about just how it's terrifying, and then you're inside the sanctuary. And I can't help – I mean, part of that, of course, is just nature of the location.
Mm-hmm.
But the other part is I can imagine that you're walking along this ledge, and it is this terrifying ordeal. You know, you're imagining yourself plummeting and falling and dying, and then you emerge into this decorated cavern with these images painted on the walls, and you're in this holy sanctuary. Secluded from everything else.
Yeah, I think what you're emphasizing there is that the seclusion, the isolation, the inaccessibility, and the danger are not bugs but features.
Mm-hmm.
They're part of the religious experience generated in getting to this place believed to be holy.
Right. So I can see the same situation being in place if you were having to climb this rope to finally emerge into a sanctuary.
Yeah. An interesting note on the same subject, but this is from a different part of Getachew Haile's history. Haile also writes that there are two words meaning monastery. He doesn't say the language specifically, but I'm pretty sure he's talking about Amharic, the Ethiopian language of today. But he says that these two words today meaning monastery. The first word is Dabur, which literally comes from the word meaning mountain, as in Mount Sinai. And then the other word is Gadam, which comes from a word meaning wilderness, as in John the Baptist referring to himself as a voice crying out in the wilderness. And I loved that. That's so interesting. So you got these two words, both mean monastery. One means mountain and one means wilderness.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that ties in nicely with topics we've discussed on the show before, how high elevation can impact the mind. Mm-hmm. And then also the recharging effects of being in a natural environment.
Yeah, and I think you read this part also where he talks about they do sometimes refer to different types of monasteries.
Right.
So like the Dabur Monastery would be a monastery that is on top of a mountain or is a certain type of like major officially recognized monastery. Meanwhile, a Gadam Monastery I think can be more like is – can be more unofficially recognized or can be anywhere.
Right. Yeah. And so thus it becomes very difficult to actually have a good count on how many Ethiopian monasteries exist.
Yeah. So that was, anyway, the legacy of the first of the nine saints. The second one is known as Pantaleon or Pantaleon, called Pantaleon of the Cell because he allegedly never once left his tiny cell after he entered it. So this guy, one of the vows he takes is a vow to be sealed in this room. He keeps his vow to remain inside for 45 years until his death.
Wow.
The next one is Yeshak or Isaac or Garima. So many of them have multiple names they're known by. This one is believed to have been born a prince but then became a monk. There's Afsi. His hagiographer writes that he never died but instead ascended directly into heaven like Elijah or like Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so far each of these are kind of hitting on like sort of traditional tropes of the holy man or the hermit or certainly the prince that becomes a holy man is very much in keeping with the Buddha.
Yes, yes. And then you got the next five. No bio details on these. Haile didn't have much about them except like when their feast days are celebrated. But you've got Gubba, Aleph, Yamata, Lykanos, and Sema. And Haile writes that the monks you would meet in Ethiopia today often like to trace their lineage to one of the nine saints. So they can say, oh, I'm of the tradition of Yamata, or I'm of the tradition of Pantaleon. But anyway, this period, the nine saints period, would be the 5th to 6th century. And this appeared to be a boom time for Christianity and monks in Ethiopia. Haile mentions that an Egyptian monk named Cosmos Indicopliustes wrote of visiting the coastal regions of Ethiopia along the Red Sea in the year 525, and that Indicopliustes wrote at the time that the churches and the monasteries in Ethiopia were thriving. However, sometime in the next few hundred years, definitely by the 10th century, the political and religious power center of the city of Aksum and the Aksum Empire was reduced to ruins. And the cause of this is not known for sure, though there are some unsubstantiated legends about an uprising against the church by non-Christians. But we don't know exactly what happened there. But eventually, Haile writes that the power vacuum was filled by a new ruling dynasty, the Zagwe, which lasted until around 1270.
Yeah, I was reading about this uprising in the History of Ethiopia by Sahid A. Adejumobi. And basically, the chief antagonist that is attributed to what is sometimes called the Ethiopian Dark Age was the non-Christian queen Gudit. She, according to these stories, usurped the throne by force and reigned for 40 years and then passed the crown on to her descendants, who were then eventually overthrown by Mara Takla Hemanat, an Aga overlord. And then this overlord married a female descendant of the Aksumite monarchs of old and started the Zagwe dynasty that you mentioned already. But there are apparently a lot of inconsistencies about Gudit, about who she was, where she came from, what exactly she did aside from decimating the capital and overturning the prior rule. Mm. So it seems rather difficult to separate the history and the mythology. Often the details of one story conflict with those of another. For instance, in one telling at least, she is described as being of Jewish origin, thus Gudit, Judith, there being potentially some connection there.
Yeah, Haile doesn't seem to credit the story from what I can tell. He mentions that the names applied to this woman, for example, like Gudit or Isato, if she existed, are probably not even her real names, but they're derogatory terms applied to her by people who saw her as a villain if she was, in fact, a real figure. So this period seems murky.
Right.
But whatever led from the collapse of the Aksum Kingdom to the foundation of the Zagwe dynasty, it's under the Zagwe kingdom that the rock-hewn churches of Lalibela are traditionally said to have been designed and constructed. So let's turn to the king, Lalibela.
Yes, Lalibela, the namesake of the city of Lalibela. Mm-hmm. Emperor Gebre Meskel Lalibela, who lived 1181 through 1221, and who again was part of the Zagwe dynasty. That dynasty lasted from the year 900 to the year 1270.
I think that's got to be a rough estimate on the beginning of it, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So I've seen it alleged in several sources that the name of this king, that Lalibela, means something about bees, like, quote, his sovereignty is recognized by bees, or that it just means surrounded by bees. I have not found that claim sourced to its origin or explained anywhere that looked too solid to me, so a question mark on that one. But I hope it's true because I like it.
It's an absolutely wonderful magical gimmick for a monarch.
Yeah,
they're surrounded by bees. And yeah, and just really this whole dynastic struggle that we're describing here. Ethiopian history is amazing, and I'm glad that I'm finally digging into it some. So the Zogwe dynasty. They had to make their capital in a new location. The previous one had been decimated by the prior rule. So they made their capital in Roa, which later took the name of the monarch that we're talking about, Lalibela. Mm-hmm. So Lalibela is best remembered today for these monoliths that he builds or has built or completes the building of.
You mean the rock-hewn churches?
Yes, the rock-hewn churches. Yeah, either the tales are, differ, but either he commanded their construction or he oversaw their completion. Mm-hmm. At any rate, his name is kind of like stamped on them historically.
I think there's one other version in which his widow had at least one of the churches built in her husband's memory.
Ah, okay.
Now, that's the traditional telling. I was reading a short essay about the churches by a scholar of African arts named Kristen Windmiller Luna. And she points out that archaeologists have not actually established precise dates for the construction of the different parts of the Lalibela complex, but that the most common view among scholars is that these churches were probably actually constructed in stages over a longer period of time, maybe in like four or five different phases between the 7th and the 13th centuries. But again, we don't really know for sure. And in addition to the traditional ascription to Lalibela, the king's reign would fall right toward the end of this hypothetical multi-phase construction period.
Yeah, so at any rate, his name is highly associated with them. And of course, the town bears his name. There are some other stories you'll encounter out there about that have alternate hypotheses for their creation. There was one I saw mentioned in a BBC article even stating that the Knights Templars may have created them, but I don't think anybody really gives those stories a lot of they don't give them a lot of attention. I think this is the primary hypothesis that everyone agrees with.
Wait, by History Channel logic, are the Knights Templars also – is that the same as the aliens hypothesis because the Knights Templars were aliens.
Knights Templar extremism is like a gateway to ancient aliens.
Okay.
If you just keep following and you keep just really if you really want everything to be the Knights Templars, at the end of it you're just going to wind up in ancient aliens territory. Yeah. That's my take on it. Not that the Templars are not in and of themselves fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I'd actually love to come back to them on invention. I think they arguably factor into certainly some economic inventions over time.
Okay.
But anyway, that's for another day.
But let's explore that traditional story attributing the rock-hewn churches directly to Lalibela.
Now, of this, though, there are two different versions at least that I came across. One is that Lalibela had himself visited Jerusalem sometime around, say, 1187, just before the Crusader held city fell back into the hands of Islamic forces.
So like many Christians at the time, many Christians of means would have wanted to make a pilgrimage to what they believed was the birthplace of Christ,
right?
For like religious devotion.
Yeah, and so he would have made this pilgrimage potentially.
Yes.
Now another version is that he didn't actually travel there, but he saw Jerusalem in a dream and particularly probably in a dream after its fall back into Islamic hands.
Wait a minute. I just made a big mistake. I said birthplace of Christ. Jerusalem is not the birthplace of Christ, is it very important in
yes.
Christian tradition.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yes.
Yeah, he came into Jerusalem on a donkey, but in none of the Gospels does it say he was born in Jerusalem. Sorry, just had to clean that up.
Oh, yeah, no worries. Well, in either case, either he visited Jerusalem and then it fell, or Jerusalem fell and then he saw a vision of it in his dreams, mm-hmm. but then it becomes clear to him I need to create a new Jerusalem right here in Christian Ethiopia. And then since no one can travel to Jerusalem now among the Christians, then all the Ethiopian Christians can simply travel here and have a religious experience here in this city. And so thus the creation of these 11 monolithic churches, each plunging up to 50 meters in the earth or roughly 164 feet. And of course, the idea again would be that since Christian pilgrims could no longer trek to Jerusalem, this would serve as a new center of pilgrimage. And indeed, it does remain an important pilgrimage destination for Ethiopian Christians. Christmas Eve, which is known as Genna in Ethiopian traditions, is a favorite time to visit, with people walking hundreds of miles or more to visit the churches and engage in rites of fasting, prayer, and celebration.
Yeah, and that's one thing that makes these churches special today. I was reading again in that piece by Kristen Windmiller Luna that some of the earliest of these structures may have originally served civic functions, like as palaces or fortresses, but at some point they became these churches as destinations for pilgrimage. And their location makes them different from some of the, you know, you would think of the big grand Catholic cathedrals that you might find in the middle of a huge city. Today, these churches are somewhat remote. They're not in the center of the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. And so it makes sense to think of them as a site of pilgrimage. They're a place you would have to go to in a journey to show your devotion.
Yeah, and we were talking about visiting these sites on mountaintops and how there's like the physical ordeal of climbing up to reach them. Mm-hmm. And with these temples that are essentially, you know, just dug out of these quarries in the earth, you have to climb down to visit them. Like, they're accessible via like steep winding stairs and tunnels and tunnel complexes. So you have a very similar situation, except instead of an ascent, it is a descent.
So let's look at these 11 churches.
All right. So they're arranged into three groups, and each one differs in exact size, rock color, architectural style. And according to UNESCO, because they are UNESCO World Heritage Sites, their translated names are as follows. There's the House of the Savior of the World, and this is thought to be the largest of these monolithic churches. There's the House of Mary. There's the House of the Cross. There's the House of Virgins. There's the House of Golgotha Michael, which contains life-size depictions of the 12 apostles carved into the walls, and apparently only four are visible to the public, and the others are kept hidden behind like drapes and curtains. Mm-hmm. There's the House of Emmanuel. There's the House of Saint Mercurios, and this was possibly a former residence. There's the House of Abbot Libanos. There's House of Gabriel Raphael. This was also possibly a former residence. There's the House of Holy Bread. And then finally, there is the House of St. George. This is the one, if you see like an Instagram post for this podcast episode, this is the image you're seeing because it has this kind of cruciform plan to it, shaped like a cross, specifically a Greek cross. And if you view it from above, it's really – when I first saw an image of it from above, I wasn't even sure what I was looking at.
Yeah. There's a quality to it. I think you were actually talking about this before we started recording, how it's the kind of architectural marvel that is difficult to appreciate from a single photograph, mm-hmm. because in only seeing it from one perspective, you don't really understand what's so marvelous about it. You have to see it from multiple different photos from different angles to start to appreciate it.
Yes, absolutely, because photographs taken from down inside the quarry, the pit, courtyard pit, whatever you want to call it, those are impressive because you see this image of this building here just rising up. And if you don't know, you might just assume that it was built, that it was constructed out of bricks.
Maybe surrounded by walls.
Yeah. But then when you see it from above, it's like, what is this strange cross surrounded by pit on all sides that's just sort of emerging from the wilderness landscape all around it?
Yeah. So again, this is the Church of St. George we're talking about. I guess let's take a closer look at this one to see what's so architecturally special about it. You mentioned the idea of it plunging into the earth. I think that's the perfect way to describe the Church of St. George. It doesn't rise up from the earth like a regular church or a regular building. It rises from the bottom of a pit And the pit is a pit carved into natural rock. Mm-hmm. So as you approach the church, you're walking along a natural rock surface, not a paved area, but just exposed rock from planet Earth. And as you keep going, you realize you are approaching a deep rectangular hole in the ground with edges dropping straight off. And from the top, you know, the lip of the pit down to the bottom, I think it's roughly 12 meters or 40 feet, roughly. The pit being maybe 25 meters or about 80 feet wide square. And then in the middle of this rectangular pit, there's this huge building in the shape of a Greek cross, as you mentioned, which looks kind of like a plus sign, approximately as tall as the ground you're standing on, though the edges of the pit are not exactly all at the same height. So it depends on where you're standing. It might be taller than where you are. It might be a little below you. But this cross-shaped building in the center of the pit is the church. And as the name suggests, again, it's not built but carved directly out of the existing basaltic rock. It is one unbroken hunk of natural stone released from the earth by hammer and chisel.
Yeah, it's just it's amazing to even think about. And we've never been. Obviously, I look forward to hearing from anyone out there who has visited this site and can describe what it was like to see this in person. But it's such a drastically different model of making a building compared to everything else that has been the norm.
You know, it's not just the case for this church. I mean, this is true of many types of sacred destinations and holy buildings, but its weirdness makes it holy.
Yeah.
Like the weirdness of the architectural construction here contributes to the alienated feeling you get that I think, you know, it's the same reason that you're far less likely to have a religious experience in a very normal building, in an office building full of cubicles and hallways with, you know, carpeted floors and stuff. When you go into a cathedral, this is not like the other buildings you go into. It's very weird, and the weirdness itself puts you in a kind of like disoriented, alienated state of mind that makes you prone to having feelings of connection with higher beings and stuff like that. And I think the architectural weirdness here probably does a similar thing.
Yeah, I mean, and it's probably the reason why some of the tales say that, oh, the angels helped them construct it, you know.
Yes.
Which, again, is not to inspire anybody to go nuts with ancient aliens stuff here. But just like the idea that this is such a drastically different building from anything we're used to, like the divine imprint is here.
Yeah. So another thing that's really cool about it is I mentioned you can walk up to the edge of this pit. There's the building rising up from the bottom of the pit. The edges of the pit are a straight drop off around all the sides. So how do you get into the church? Well, apparently the bottom of the pit is accessed via a narrow descending canyon, and then which turns into a tunnel that is carved into the rock formation nearby. So again, this is something where somebody had to carve an access ramp down through the existing native living rock there in this narrow tunnel, and then you come out in the courtyard below.
Yeah, and I can only assume that, you know, this is, again, the monastic tradition, the idea of the importance of pilgrimage coming into play here. Like, it is not a thing that should be easy to access. It is supposed to be a journey to the bottom.
Now, apparently there are other openings in the walls of this courtyard pit which give access to chambers that can be used for different things, like sometimes housing, I think, or storage, or as crypts.
Yeah, UNESCO describes there being all these sites being connected via, quote, drainage ditches, trenches, and ceremonial passages, some of which opening to hermit caves and catacombs.
Now, I mentioned there was a scientific paper we were going to reference. Maybe we should take a break and then come back to look at that real quick.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
All right, we're back.
All right, so earlier we mentioned a scientific paper that would be examining some of the geological properties of these rock-hewn churches. And so this paper was published in the Journal of African Earth Sciences called Geological and Geotechnical Properties of the Medieval Rock-hewn Churches of Lalibela, Northern Ethiopia by Asfawosin Asrat and Yudit Ayalu. And the authors here use a metric called the rock mass rating to characterize the constituents and the condition of the rocks that make up the churches of Lalibela. And they found that these churches are mostly carved from, quote, medium strength to strong, intact, scoriaceous basalt rocks. Now, what does scoriaceous basalt rocks mean? Scoriaceous rocks, basalt rocks, would be dark-colored volcanic rocks with a porous or a vesicular texture. So pores or vesicles, what does that mean in rock terms? Well, these are little holes, basically little bubbles that are created when magma with dissolved gas content erupts and then is exposed to the surface. And then some of that dissolved gas volatilizes and forms bubbles, which can become hardened into the rock as the lava cools. So a very extreme form of this you might have encountered was probably something like pumice, you know, that has huge holes in it.
Mm-hmm.
This, I think, is not quite that porous, but still it's porous. It's got like holes and little tunnels and bubbles in it.
It makes me think of cooking pancakes, this description, you know, where you get the little bubbles on top.
It's pretty much exactly like that, yeah. So the authors find several threats to the material integrity of the rock-hewn churches. The churches are somewhat vulnerable to the elements. They write, quote, "Most of the rock-hewn churches are affected by pre-carving cooling joints and bedding plane discontinuities, and by mostly but not necessarily post-carving tectonic and seismic-induced cracks and fractures." So for several reasons having to do with the existing, you know, mass of rock there and with things brought on by the carving and excavation of these building faces, there are cracks and fractures and vulnerabilities in the buildings and their structure. But they also say, though most of the churches are hewn from medium to high strength rock mass, discontinuities make them vulnerable to other deteriorating agents, mainly weathering and water infiltration. Again, it's not hard to see how porous rocks are subject to water infiltration. Quote, "The scoriaceous basalt, which is porous and permeable, allows easy passage of water, while the underlying basalt is impermeable, increasing the residence time of water in the porous material, causing deep weathering and subsequent loss of material in some of the churches and adjoining courtyards." So while they're still beautiful to see today, these buildings are under some material strain.
Yeah, I was reading about this on UNESCO's website, and they point out, another thing they point out is the drainage ditches. We mentioned already that that's part of sort of the system of tunnels and ditches around these structures.
Right. It's a rock pit. You need some way to drain it.
Right.
Yeah.
But the thing is that those ditches were filled in with dirt some time ago. And this resulted in a lot of flooding and water damage over the years before they were then cleared out again in the early 20th century. I guess that's one of the things to keep in mind about structures that have existed for as long as these is there's plenty of time for there to be periods of neglect,
yeah.
Even if there are not periods of outright assault on them.
Right.
So water damage occurred then. You already mentioned the seismic activity that seemed to have damaged them as well. As such, they are all in fairly degraded shape at this point and require monitoring despite the construction of shelters over several of them. In fact, the House of Emmanuel, one of the 11 we listed earlier, is listed as being in danger of collapse. And those shelters too, and you'll see these shelters if you look up pictures of these today, they're quite controversial as well apparently because they're certainly sheltering these structures from the elements. But in some cases, they might actually be damaging the very structures they're protecting. And some of them are arguably also at risk to collapse during storms. And at the very least, they impact the visual presentation and serve, according to the Associated Foreign Press, as, quote, "a symbol of the neglect that Lalibela residents say they and the complex endure." On top of this, there's the degradation to various paintings, sculptures, and bas-reliefs inside the temples. And even though the churches are protected by both the church and the state in Ethiopia, apparently this doesn't always translate into there being like a lot of support and effort given towards the needs because there's still, according to UNESCO, quote, "a need for stronger planning controls for the setting of the churches that addresses housing, land use, tourism, and for a management plan to be developed that integrates the conservation action plan and addresses the overall sustainable development of the area with the involvement of the local population." Now, I was looking around. It does seem like this remains something that is being discussed, and UNESCO is still discussing possible plans to better protect these churches. And there has been increased attention even in the past year with, for instance, French President Emmanuel Macron visiting the site of these churches in Ethiopia.
Yeah, this raises something that has come up with a number of the topics we've done about, old, wonderful pieces of architecture. Mm-hmm. which is that obviously, you know, it makes sense to put things in place to protect structures from being directly damaged by human behavior. But when something is being sort of like naturally weathered suffering, you know, just from the exposure to the natural forces that permeate the environment, I think then it becomes harder to know exactly what to do. Like, so imagine you're just dealing with the issue of, would it be better to put up a shelter over one of these churches to prevent rain from falling on it or not? I mean, and so maybe putting that up, you would say, could prevent some water damage from accumulating over time, but also that damage is relatively slow to happen. And in the meantime, everybody who goes on pilgrimage to this church, now the pilgrimage is under this big artificial shelter.
Right. And then I can only imagine that a site like this offers unique challenges as it is built unlike buildings are typically constructed, you know? Yeah, there are a number of concerns that come together here. And also coming back to just the nature of buildings, the nature of sculpture, the nature of anything humans have made, something like this, certainly from a human perspective, it is long-lived. It is very durable. It may even seem to be eternal. But from a geologic standpoint, it is quite frail. It is frailer than the thing that came before it. And you know, therefore, it's foolish to think that it will just be able to remain down there at the bottom of this this pit and remain, you know, untouched. No, I mean it's going to follow the you know, the natural laws of erosion like everything else. All right, so there you have it: the churches of Lalibela in Ethiopia, just amazing structures. Again, we have not visited this site in person, but we know that since we have listeners out there from all over the world, and we have listeners that are well traveled in many cases. We know some of you have been there, and we would love to hear of your experiences. Or if you haven't actually been to these monolithic churches, perhaps you've been to some of the other monolithic churches, and there are a handful elsewhere in the world. We'd love to hear about your experiences there. In the meantime, if you want to check out more episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That'll redirect you to one of the many places you can find us. You can find the show wherever you get your podcasts. And wherever that happens to be, just make sure that you subscribe. Make sure that you rate and review us. And tell a friend. Let someone else know that Stuff to Blow Your Mind or our other show, Invention, you know, helps get you through the day or taught you something you didn't know about previously.
Huge thanks, as always, to our awesome audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.